brought to you by the Computer History Museum.
Welcome to From the Archives of the Computer History Museum. I'm curator Chris Garcia.
Computer History Museum fellow Evelyn Barrison's career in technology stretches back to the 1940s. Following work at New York University and Brooklyn Polytechnic, in 1951 she joined Electronic Computer Corporation as the head of the Logic Design Department. Among the projects she completed there was a range calculator for the U.S. Army. In 1969, she founded Redactron Corporation, a company that provided one of the first electronic word processors. In this first part of her oral history conducted by Gardner Hendry in 2014, Barrison discusses her education as well as her early work with electronic digital computers.
So I took all my mathematics at Brooklyn Polytech. In Brooklyn, I had to get to Brooklyn. I went to Brooklyn. And all my physics and chemistry and so on at NYU. And all my literature art at Hunter.
So you split up.
There was no other place to take the courses.
But that was allowed.
They made arrangements for each other. I don't know how they arranged it because Brooklyn Poly was a paid school. Somebody paid them to provide the courses that would be needed in other places, and they didn't pay the they cut down on the number of teachers they had, of course. Number of professors they had teaching. And sometimes I always had to arrange it so that I was in the same school, same place on any one day. Yes. Like otherwise I would have had to go from 68th Street to Brooklyn. I couldn't get to Hunter at 68th Street, which is 68th Street and Park Avenue. I couldn't get from there. And then between classes that ended at 8 o'clock and one that started at Brooklyn Poly at 8. Couldn't do that. That was in Brooklyn. So I had to arrange it. But we did it and I got through all that okay. And I was at that time, since Brooklyn Poly was an all boys school, the only woman in the school. And the only woman who had ever been in Brooklyn Poly. I always thought that was funny. I had a trail of boys behind me as I went to the subway every night.
That's funny. That is. Wow.
And indirectly, actually, that's the way I married my husband, because it's an aside from this, but yeah. One of the guys there whom I dated at Brooklyn Poly went to live in Israel, where my husband had gone to live. And when he was sent to this country, this other guy gave him my phone number. And that's how I met him.
Really?
Wow. So Brooklyn Poly was very good for me. Well,
I'm
graduating. It's 1945. I graduated from I graduated at NYU. And what happened in the last year or two of college, as I was known to the people at NYU, and I have no memory at all of how this happened. I got a full scholarship to the, I stayed there and I got a full, now it took me 6 years to get through college because I was going at night, because I was taking small, you know, only classes, you know, only a certain number that I could fit in. So it took me quite a while to get through college. But then I had started at 15, so I wasn't very old. I had the scholarship. I finished at NYU, and then I wanted to go to graduate school, so I was told to apply to the government. Now, this was my first nuclear physics class, started on August 6th, 1945, the very day that the bomb was dropped. We were all sort of paralyzed with the fact, with knowing that had happened on that day. Yeah. Actually, I knew about it earlier. I found out about the Manhattan Project by having some drinks with a guy in a bar about 1944, 43, something. And he had been working on it at Columbia. And he told me all about it. All about it. I guess he was drunk. I don't know. I was stunned. And not long after that, I bumped into a guy that I had been in high school with in uniform. And I said, on Times Square, that's where I worked. I mean, it was on 45th Street. Yeah. So I said, oh, he said he was at Princeton. I said, oh, you must be on that bomb job. And he said, shut up. And we went into the Astor Bar, I remember, and I told him how I had learned about it. And he told me to just never say a word about it. I never said a word about it until long after the war to anybody, but I knew all about it.
Wow.
And I'm saying to myself, how many other people already know this?
Yes. And how many of them are not friendly to the United States? Are there any of them?
I don't know.
Anyway,
I got an Atomic Energy Commission fellowship. They started that, I think it was started in 46. Because there were so few physicists in the United States, and they wanted to build up. That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
That was why. So anybody who already was taking physics, I don't think it was a particularly honored thing, but
yes,
it was something that the government wanted to make sure we had enough of. So I did graduate work mostly, and the thesis was on meson energy. We built our own cloud chamber. Two or three of us who were working on the project built a cloud chamber up on the roof of NYU.
Okay.
It's right, I can't see it from this place, but it's right across Washington Square, and I can still see the place we worked in.
Wow.
from this house. It had been a garden.
Yes.
On the roof.
Yes, a roof garden.
A roof garden, and we took it over and built this cloud chamber and measured mesons. And I have to tell you one more thing. When you needed particles, what we did, we had a roll of lead. Just a roll of lead.
Yeah.
You know, about
lead sheet.
About a quarter of an inch thick, rolled up. And inside it, we had hanging a little bottle with cesium in it. Cesium-60, I think it is.
Okay.
And that's what we used. We picked it up with the bottle, open to the world, put it on top of
the cloud chamber,
and tested it, and did what we had to do. Never occurred to us that we were getting cesium-60.
Or getting radiation.
Or getting radiation at all. I mean, we knew it, of course. We knew it.
But
we didn't.
There wasn't any data.
Nobody knew about
radiation sickness or how much you could stand it.
You know, you just sat there all the time, you know, sitting in this little lead thing.
And the top of the lead thing.
There was no top on it.
The radiation just went up to the sky.
I think of it now.
Oh, my goodness.
Anyway, so that was that. And we published a letter in the Physical Review.
Okay.
But about that time, I had met my husband. It was 5 years to build a cloud chamber duel. That took a lot of time. And I met my husband. We were not married, and we wanted to get married. And he had emigrated to Israel from Britain, from London.
Okay.
Because his family had always been Zionists. I knew nothing about Zionism, nothing about Israel. My family were not interested in it. They were very secular. And they never believed in religion at all.
Yeah.
They were kind of socialists.
Yeah,
really.
Okay.
And his family were a religious Orthodox family, which were anathema to me.
Yeah.
But his brother had gone to Israel in 19... His brother had been in the British Army, of course, for 6 years in India, had gone to Israel in 1948 and was killed in the war.
Oh, no.
And so the family were particularly, connected to Israel and its history and
yes.
what it was doing. And he had emigrated to Israel in 1950.
Okay.
When he was out of college. And I finally, it's a long story, I finally decided that I would go to Israel with him. And then I didn't have any money, of course. I didn't have any money.
Yeah.
I remember some guy. No, I was still at the lab. I was at NYU. I had a fellowship which was $1,600 a year, so I had moved down here. Actually, I lived on East 7th Street in the east side of the village.
Okay.
It wasn't really the village; it was the Lower East Side, and it was just a. And I had a roommate I was very fond of, and we decided to get married. We got married in December, and he went off to Israel, and I was supposed to follow him. And I did follow him thereafter, quite a while later. In the meantime, I had to get a job because I had to get some money. He was earning money, but not very much. In Israel in those days, the country had just started, a couple of years before then, in 48. This was 51 when we got married.
Yes.
So it was, there was not much food there. I lost 10 pounds the first month I was there. And it was not very easy to live there. And so actually I did go there in that year. But before I did that, I told my thesis advisor that I really needed to get out and get some work done. And I would work at night or something. I didn't know what would happen with my thesis because I hadn't finished it.
Yes.
We had gotten a few particles, but not enough to qualify. And it's a long story, but anyway, that's fundamentally what happened. And I,
when your thesis was going to be based on?
On meson energy,
yes.
Yeah.
On meson energy.
Anderson, though, had an airplane and a lot of money at Caltech. And he had, just about that time when we were, trying to finish it, he had come out with an enormous amount of data that we didn't have because we didn't have the resources.
Yes.
And he did the whole thing in an Army airplane.
So he'd gone up and put a cloud chamber in an airplane.
And he had a cloud chamber somebody else built. Somebody else built a cloud chamber, of course, not him.
Yes.
At Caltech, you could do that. You couldn't do that at NYU.
Yeah, right. Okay.
You had to build all your own equipment. We built all our Geiger counters.
Okay.
You had to build everything.
Yes.
It was a very good experience for me, but it just made the whole thing be much longer. Now, I wasn't suffering in the sense that I had a full scholarship, which I would keep.
Right.
I mean, not just a scholarship, it was a fellowship, so I got paid, actually.
Yes.
$1,600 a year, which I lived on alone. I mean, with a roommate.
Okay.
I'm taking too much time over this.
And so, yeah, you quit the job as a tech. Or were you doing that?
No,
too?
Yes, I quit my job. I think I quit the job as a tech. I think I told you in 1945 when I went to graduate school, with a scholarship.
Yes. All right, good.
And I did explain that.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was.
I understand.
I had an income. I could not live without an income.
Yeah.
My parents could not support me.
I understand.
So I had to get a job. And I had to get a more paying job than that. And so I went to my advisor and I asked him told him what the story was. And he said, well, he told me about a guy who was a headhunter who was pretty good with people in the physics department getting jobs. So I went down to see him and talked to him. And he said, there are no jobs in physics now, he said, because the Korean War was on. And the president, who was Truman, decided that we were not going to hire anybody anymore because we just didn't have the money for it. We were fighting a war in Korea. So he said, there just aren't any jobs. And I said, have you heard of any jobs in computers? I have no idea why I said that. I have no idea of where I knew about computers.
Yes, but somehow.
But somehow I had read somewhere about computers. And I just said it. And he said to me, I never heard of computers. But this morning I got a phone call from somebody in Brooklyn who's looking for people for a computer company. This morning. And I have been so lucky.
Yeah.
Just in. And that's what happened. I went over to the computer company. It was called Electronic Computer Corporation. I had never heard of it. they gave me an example. The guy who was the head of engineering, Gene Leonard, his name was, Eugene Leonard, he gave me a test to design a network. Mm-hmm. I designed a network, I gave it back to him, and I was hired. And I was hired as a logic designer, which they didn't have. That's wow. How I got the job. This seems to happen to me, and I've been just unbelievably lucky. So I got started on the very beginning. This was in October of 1951. And they had hired a number of people, most of them, this was after the war, remember, most of them kids who had come out of City College. And so on. But the people who started the company had already designed computers because there were a group of people there, I think three or four, who had come from UNIVAC.
Ah.
The guy who started the company was Sam Lubkin.
Okay.
Sam Lubkin, if I got that name right, I think I've got a little wrong, but anyway, he was in the Bureau of Standards, and they had built a computer in the Bureau of Standards. I forgot the name of it, SEAC, that's right. And he had done the logic. He was a mathematician, and he was he had a PhD in mathematics. He was really a wonderful mathematician. I mean, he was very incredibly smart.
Yes.
But he would never have hired me. He was afraid of women. He never talked to me. He was just afraid of women. I guess because he was, I don't know why, he was shy. But Gene Leonard was not like that. He was perfectly open, and he didn't mind hiring women.
Okay.
I did this. I had more education than most of the other kids they hired out of school. Yeah. I mean, I had 5 years in graduate school. So he hired me. At $4,500 a month from $1,600 is more money than I ever thought I would make in my life. And they sat me down, and I started to, and I was put to design immediately. No education at all. The machine for the for designing ranges for guns for this. For the Argonne lab.
Oh, so the same thing that ENIAC was originally for doing.
Was it really?
ENIAC was designed to do firing tables.
I didn't know that.
Yes, the ENIAC was a project to speed up making the firing tables for guns because they were coming out with new guns and they were calculating the firing tables with lots of women, you know, in a room.
Oh, and calculators.
On calculators.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
And so they were
falling. They called the women calculators. Yeah.
And so somebody came up with the idea, of doing it electronically.
Did the ELIAC really work well?
Yes, it worked.
Yeah.
Yes.
Then why would they get it? Why did they start getting another? That was before 1951.
Oh, yes.
That was in the 40s, late 40s.
Working by 1947 or 48.
Yeah. The UNIVAC, I remember, the first commercial UNIVAC was delivered from, this is Eckert Mockley, guys worked at.
Yeah, Eckert Mockley are the people that did the ENIAC.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they went left and started UNIVAC.
But UNIVAC was the general machine, the first general machine, and it went into GE in, it was at a factory in St. Louis, I think.
It was in the Midwest, yes.
Yeah.
And it went to GE, but before that, they delivered one to the Census Bureau.
Oh, yes.
Contract. And the first commercial customer, I believe, don't hold me to it. Was GE,
It was GE, I remember that. Yeah. Anyway, the UNIVAC was the first certain, and that was 49.
Yes.
I do remember that, certain that was the year.
Okay.
So this was only 2 years later.
Yeah, my goodness. And so they had a contract from...
And Sam Lubkin from Bureau of Standards first started, he was from Brooklyn, his family was from Brooklyn, so he started it in Brooklyn. And he got these people from Eckert Mockley. And the reason he got the people from Eckert Mockley was This was the time of the terrible business of getting people who were supposedly communists and putting them. It was MacArthur time.
Yes, okay.
And these guys all had backgrounds of the people who came to our company. Must have had, it was never discussed, but they had backgrounds that were a problem, and the Eckert Mockley people said they couldn't work there anymore. They couldn't get secret clearance, and you needed clearance because they were doing things for the government.
Got it. Okay.
Whereas, so they, I don't know if that was true of Sam Lupkin either. I don't know.
Yes.
I never had any inkling of that. But the other guys I know left because they were sort of asked to leave.
Okay.
And they couldn't get clearance. None of them really had any real problems. But they had to go because of MacArthur.
Wow. Okay.
So I was benefited because there were people there who had designed computers before. I really had a real advantage.
Yes.
And one of them, you know, sort of sketched out the general idea and said, design it. And I sat down and designed this machine I told you about, which had to have a vector capability. And maybe that's what was different, that the other machine was slow. It probably didn't, it surely didn't have a
yes,
vector count.
Of course they did not.
Yeah.
No, it had separate, it wasn't really a general purpose computer.
See, oh, really?
The ENIAC. The ENIAC had special, had adders, subtractors, multiply units.
You mean it was a copy of a calculator?
Square root unit.
You mean it was a calculator, really?
It was programmed. They figured out how.
Did they do it with plugs?
Plugs. Originally. And then some brilliant person figured out how to use the function tables that it also to actually program it faster. But it was not a stored program computer.
Oh, then it wasn't really a computer.
Well, yes, it was the first. But it had many of the functions of a computer. Okay? It's like
It
was not a stored program machine.
Mind, if you don't have a branch instruction, it's not a computer.
I think it did.
Not plug board. Yeah, but
yeah. You could still do.
Yeah, I guess it could be.
Of course. You could have a comparator.
But I didn't really know it was like that. I thought it was a stored program machine always.
No, it was not. They haven't invented that yet.
Thank you for telling me.
Okay.
I didn't know. Right. Anyway, the machine that I designed was a stored program, but it was all tubes. You know.
So I'm sure
and the memory was a magnetic drum.
Yes, okay.
And it was about so high and so big around.
Do you remember?
I remember.
Was
it.
There a name for it or a product name?
It was just called the Argonne machine.
The Argonne.
Not Argonne.
Aberdeen. Was it Aberdeen Proving Ground?
I think it must have been. Must have been.
Argonne.
Why does Argonne?
Was a national lab
was an,
of the
Atomic
Energy Commission. Aberdeen.
Yeah,
was
you know why?
The Army's.
Because I've been on the Brookhaven National Lab board for years. I'm not on it now. I just stopped this year, but for about 13 years. And so I'm so used to calling to be talking about Argonne because that was another national lab that we often did work with.
Right.
So that's why I think I made the mistake.
Okay.
But it was Aberdeen. You're right. It was Aberdeen.
Good.
Yeah.
All right. So you...
I wouldn't have thought I could forget that.
Okay.
So we designed it with a magnetic drum. And most of, essentially, the active memory was essentially largely on the drum. Where you had a head at one place and recirculating delay lines on it.
So
that's
it was
where all
fundamentally a serial machine then.
Oh yeah, almost all the machines you built those days, I think I don't know the others,
because
where would
it was
you
too
put
expensive.
It? It was too expensive to put them all in flip flops, which
and
is the only
parallel,
other. Yeah, you had a few flip flops at each end.
Yeah.
For buffer.
Right.
And the rest of it was all on the machine.
Okay.
It was slow, but it could do the job. I mean,
vector instructions
it did it.
Probably was very fast in doing
Yes.
Kinds
and
of
I think that what happened at Aberdeen was that that machine was probably too slow, and that's why they ordered another one that was all electronic. And that had a vector.
And had stored program.
And had stored program, and had vector capability.
Okay.
And that was interesting doing that vector. I enjoyed that. I remember.
Okay.
And since I didn't know it had never been done, I didn't know anything.
Were you the only logic designer, or were there?
I was the only logic designer then.
So you had to design all the logic for
all of it. All of it. Wow. There was nobody else I worked with. In fact,
yeah, other people worked on circuits and
they worked on this. Oh yeah, the circuits and so on, and they tested this. And there were a lot of mechanical stuff. I mean, there was the drum and there was an input out, but I don't remember what there was. Yeah. But there were mechanical things that it needed. We had a physical laboratory. We had a workspace in which people who really did things with their hands did them.
Yes.
So there were physical activities involved, and we used these tubes.
Very good.
It was so hot in the summer. Oh. We didn't have air conditioning. We didn't have anything.
Oh, my goodness.
It was so hot in Brooklyn in the summer that everybody used to walk around practically naked.
Wow.
You know, I was the only woman there, of course.
Yeah.
And of course, I did wear clothes.
Yeah.
But all the others, they walk around with aprons on and their asses were out.
I mean, really?
mostly in the shop.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
It's very funny. When I'll tell you another story later, but that made me very mad. Okay. So what happened was I worked there for a while, and my husband then went back, had finished his job a year or so later, went back to Israel, and I stayed on a while just to get enough money. So you needed money to go to Israel because there was nothing there. You had to bring, if you had a place to live, you had to bring a stove, you know, a refrigerator, or everything that you wanted to live with. There was nothing there. When I say nothing, I mean essentially. I mean, they just had a war.
Yes.
So it was very difficult. But what happened then, I looked around, and they were talking about computers, but there was a guy from Princeton who was interested in setting up a place at the local university, which was the Technion.
Yes.
In Haifa, to start something in computers. But there was actually no jobs for me. I was pretty depressed there because there was just nothing for me to do. And my husband was very unhappy because his family were giving him a hard time, and he was sick of that. And he had spent, remember, a year or more in the United States, free of family fighting, which was going on. And so he decided that he was better off in the United States than in Israel, and we came back together. And I had written before that back to Dr. Lupkin, the guy who owned who was president of the company, and asked him if I could have my old job back. And he wrote me a letter saying yes. And only with that letter could I get my husband into the country. And the people at the embassy, the American embassy said they had never seen a place where the woman got the husband in and proved she had a job.
From the archives of the Computer History Museum is drawn from the audio holdings of the Computer History Museum. It is produced by curator Christopher J. Garcia. Music is by John Plute. We'll return to Evelyn Berezin's oral history in future editions of From the Archives. For more information about Evelyn Berezin and our oral history project, as well as other Computer History Museum events, please visit computerhistory.org. Thanks for listening.
This program was brought to you by the Computer History Museum.